America's passion for guns did not begin with the adoption of the Second Amendment, but with marketing from firearm manufacturers. That's according to our guest this hour, who will join us as we examine the history of America's gun culture and the role it plays today. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, May 13th. We will talk with the author of The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. And we will welcome your questions and your thoughts about this. Why do you think Americans love guns, or at least so many Americans love guns? Not everybody loves them, obviously. Do you? Do you own a gun? Why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Pamela Haag is a historian, author, and essayist. Her most recent book is The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first of all, what do you mean by the gunning of America?
Well, the title gets at what I think is an overlooked part of the history of the gun in America. In your introduction, you alluded to the Second Amendment, and most of the conversation about guns today and the gun debate is very driven by the Second Amendment, and that is a very exceptional part of our gun culture. Most other countries do not have constitutional protections to own guns, but there's also this less exceptional part of our gun culture, and that was the gun business. And it was the commercial life of the gun and the economic life of the gun. So the gunning of America kind of refers to much more basic questions about guns in America, more how they were produced, by whom, how they were sold, where they were sold, how markets developed. They're really trying to get more at the basic questions of the material and the economic history of the gun.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of guns in America. Have Americans always loved guns?
Well, that's a huge and fascinating question. Guns have always had a part in our culture. But one of the major points in my book is that historically, attitudes about guns have changed a great deal and changed over time. We haven't really had one consistent relationship to the gun. One of the arguments I make is that the attachment of a lot of the deep emotions and political symbolism to the gun is really much more of a recent development than we might think. A lot of that's more from the turn of the century, the early 1900s, than from the frontier or the colonial days. So while guns have always been a part of the culture for some Americans, and attitudes have ranged at any given point from Americans who loved guns to Americans who really had revulsion for them. So those attitudes have always been there, but they've changed over time. Our feelings about them, a lot of the political significance that weighs so heavily today is really a more recent invention.
Yeah. And you make the point that we didn't love guns until gun companies told us we should love guns.
Well, to push back on that a little bit, it's not that the gun industry invented feelings about guns out of whole cloth or that they did that all on their own. However, I feel that the role of the gun industry in encouraging Americans to celebrate the gun and to see the gun as about something more than just a tool is really a forgotten part of this history. So I wouldn't want to say, oh, the gun industry just invented this, but they did really stoke and kindle actively a deeper feeling about guns, really at the moment when guns lost some of their practical utility, you know, when we were turning into a post-frontier society, when we were becoming an urban and a modern society. You know, at that point, a lot of the effort in the gun industry to find new customers and to build demand really did kind of shift to talking about the gun's mystique.
Yeah.
So, and I think that part of the story is really missing. It's almost like the gun industry is invisible when we talk about guns in America, even though they're the entity that have the very most to gain from selling and promoting and celebrating the gun.
Yeah, so when maybe we didn't need the gun, or not everybody needed a gun to shoot the grizzly bear or whatever,
right?
Then what did the gun company? How did the gun company tell us or convince us that we still wanted that gun?
Exactly. That's very much a story that my book tells. And it's at the moment, really, when fewer and fewer Americans need guns, that the idea of the gun as something that fulfills emotional yearnings and desires. It becomes a sign in the early 1900s of still being able to live a rugged life, you know, life as an individual, you know, at a time when the economy was very corporatized. The Winchester Company is a major focus in my book, and they had all sorts of ad campaigns in the early 20th century to appeal to the natural instinct that, quote-unquote, real boys have to shoot. You know, so they were really trying to tap into a deeper emotional load.
So they made every little boy want to have his own BB gun or more.
Yeah, actually not a BB gun, an actual 22 caliber rifle. One of their major campaigns that also tied into military readiness and to the idea that all boys should know how to handle a rifle and they should know marksmanship. In 1917, around the years of World War I, the company started talking in their own internal correspondence about the boy plan, which is how do we draw in young male customers, and also drew on the language of psychology, and you know, this is a natural desire that all boys have to shoot, so they should learn how to handle a rifle responsibly from an early age. And they urged their sales force just to appeal directly to the boys. In a lot of states, there was no age limit at that time on when someone could buy a gun.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Winchester; it was Colt and Remington and all of the gun companies.
Yeah, Remington also appealed to the young boy customer. And they also, at this time, again, when the frontier had closed, all of the gun companies were intent on finding new frontiers. So Colt really emphasized self-defense. They noticed that there were more automobilists out there on these dusty roads, and you'd want to have a gun in your car, a revolver in your car for protection against holdups in the country. They tried to appeal to women, certainly not for the first time and not for the last time, with the idea that if you're alone in your house, you're helpless without this pistol. So there was an attempt after the West closed as a frontier just to keep the gun relevant, you know, to keep the gun meaningful and to find new frontiers, to find new places where it would be appropriate to have a gun, where there were dangers. So it was a multifaceted sales effort, and a lot of it was really about creating demand, not just fulfilling the pre-existing demand that was out there, but really learning how to create demand and find new customers. And in that sense, the gun industry was just like every other industry at the time, because modern advertisement and modern sales very much had the philosophy that you should be trying to sell more than you can easily sell. You know, you should be pushing the product. You should be trying to create desire for products.
We are talking with Pamela Hague, who is the author of The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you would like to join in. Pamela, you say Americans have a special relationship with guns. Some people celebrate the gun, others condemn the gun. Do you own a gun?
Yes, I do now. I own a Winchester rifle.
Oh, and why?
Well, because I was researching guns. The interesting thing about this book is that I didn't come into this story with any great feeling about guns. Most people who write about guns either really love guns, identify with gun culture strongly, or they're very revulsed by guns and worried about gun violence. But I really came in having not been a gun owner, but nor had I been in gun control politics. And I can talk about how I got interested in the story with kind of a roundabout way. But the point being, once I started doing the research, I just felt that buying a Winchester rifle, having the rifle, trying it out, handling it, was just part of the work.
Mm-hmm. And, well, how did you get, we have just a minute before a news break, what prompted your interest in this issue?
A ghost story. Yeah, I got interested in this through Oliver Winchester's daughter-in-law, who was purported to be a spiritualist who believed herself to be haunted by the spirits of everyone killed by Winchester rifles. So my interest actually began very indirectly through another member of the iconic Winchester family. It really began with a ghost story.
So you were investigating that ghost story, and the result is the gunning of America.
Yes.
We are talking about the gunning of America with Pamela Haag, and we do welcome your thoughts and questions. Do you own a gun, listener? Why or why not? Why do you think America has this unique relationship with guns? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with our guest, Pamela Haag, who is a historian and an author and an essayist, about her most recent book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. And we're welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So what is your attitude toward guns? Do you have a passion, a love affair with the gun or not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So, Pamela, your book is a lot on the history of America's gun culture and how America's passions for guns, develop. But how would you describe the America's gun culture today?
Well, today, when we talk about guns, we're talking about a lot more than guns. So politically and symbolically, the Second Amendment has become hugely dominant in the view of guns, when historically, it was much more of a slumbering giant. There wasn't a lot of, talk about the meanings of the Second Amendment or debate around that. Quantitatively, the gun culture today is such that we have an estimated 300 million guns in civilian hands, civilian-owned guns. So we're the most heavily armed civilian gun population. But actually, household ownership of guns has declined. Maybe in the 1950s, half of households had at least one gun. Today, that's probably closer to 34 or 35. So the trend, just in terms of the sheer quantity of guns, is toward a smaller number of consumers buying more guns. But certainly, the symbolism and the political charge attached to the gun today is truly unprecedented. I mean, having read through archives from the gun industry and then also just from the gun community and the shooting press in the 19th century, there certainly wasn't this sense of political identification that we have today around firearms. So that should be noted as a pretty recent development. Even the NRA, which is just the centerpiece of contemporary gun politics, in 1934, when the first federal firearms legislation was debated, even then the NRA wasn't this lobbying powerhouse. The president had been volunteering his services, for 2 years before that point. So a lot of what feels very central and just absolutely immovable in the debate today is fairly recent.
Well, let's take a call from Mark in Antioch, Illinois. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I came in a little late, so I may have missed it, but it seems like the conversation is not touching on the fact that the Second Amendment guaranteeing our right to own a gun was our forefathers put in, not for hunting and protection, but more so we can protect ourselves from a oppressive government, like what happened with Hitler.
Pamela?
Yeah, well, I agree that what is very exceptional and distinct in the United States gun culture and gun history is the Second Amendment. As I was saying at the beginning of the hour, I mean, that is unique to this context, and that definitely guarantees the right to own firearms. But what I'm trying to do is look at a different aspect of the gun culture that really isn't about the Constitution, isn't about the law. It is simply about the gun as a product that was made by an industry that acted and functioned very much like any other industry. So while it is true that a lot of people say, well, our gun culture is all about the exercise of my Second Amendment rights, there's this other question of what are you going to exercise those rights with? You know, where does the gun come from? How is it sold? How did that industry develop? So I don't think that, you know, it's not my contention that the Second Amendment is irrelevant, absolutely not, but that the gun industry is also a part of this story, and in my mind, it's never told, because so much of the politics are focused on the constitutional issues and debates.
Right. Charles on Facebook says, I occasionally read the National Rifle Association magazine, American Rifleman. From ads to editorials, there is a repeated verse-chorus cycle. Verse, home invaders and terrorists want to kill your family. Chorus, Obama wants to take your guns away. These are two classic sales pitches, fear and perceived scarcity, though not at all based in reality. For both guns and ammunition sales, this marketing strategy has been immensely successful. And because that marketing has such a detrimental societal effect, why can't we regulate the marketing of guns the way we regulate tobacco, alcohol, and pharmaceutical advertising?
Yes, that's a really good comment, and I would agree absolutely with his characterization of the themes, the marketing themes, and they go back a long way. There's a strong sort of First Amendment protection of even advertisement and commercial speech, so that's one impediment. But in the early 1900s, there were several calls to ban gun advertisement in detective magazines, and to really kind of tackle the emerging gun problem in the early 1900s by looking at advertisement and looking at marketing. But really, the interesting thing about the gun industry is that it was treated as so unexceptional and was treated no differently in this regard in terms of advertisement or distribution than any other product. So it's trying to unring a bell now to you know, make the gun industry work with exceptional requirements and stipulations. And the gun advertisement really from, you know, the early 20th century on was developing these themes of creating the dangers. You know, after World War One, they talked about how, well, we defended ourselves against the Hun. Now it's your turn to defend your home. Really kind of cutting out law enforcement, cutting out the institutions that are supposed to protect us as well, and focusing on this sense of perceived danger, you know, in all of these everyday spaces of life. And that was a prevalent part of advertisement even 100 years ago. Winchester, actually, at Salesforce, actually, in one internal bulletin that I quote in my book, was speculating on how to drum up interest in guns and gun sales. And they said, you know, we have to learn something from the liquor people. You know, they were really good at figuring out how to get young men to want their product. And that would be mighty good business for us, too. So the gun industry kind of learned from other luxury items, discretionary items like liquor and tobacco.
We are talking with Pamela Haag, who is the author of The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Randall and Ripon now. Hi, Randall.
Good morning. I guess this is something that's kind of I feel passionate about. As a former Army guardsman and also a former hunter, the subject I kind of wanted to bring up was the friendly fire aspect of it. And I've watched, when you watch movies and stuff, the thought always goes in my head, is where is that shot going that someone's just made? And I guess it's kind of one of my pet peeves is for the average person to, you know, pull out a pistol and start pulling a trigger. And this is something I always question myself deer hunting was, did I really know for sure where that shot went? And having bullets hit trees and a vehicle within 3 to 4 feet of me, I decided I was done with deer hunting. And it's part of this whole fear-based culture, it seems like. I decided kind of my own protest, I got rid of all the guns. I was just like, I don't want to be a part of this culture. And it's a friendly fire. I think if you ask any soldier or police officer who's been in a firefight, there's a lot of chaos, and pistols are inherently inaccurate.
Well, I'm going to jump in just because I get where you're coming from. I guess I thought, as a former, you know, former military person and a former hunter, he's concerned about how others handle guns, and I thought we might even be going into the concealed carry laws that we now have. But what do you make of that, Pamela?
It's a really interesting comment, and actually. Speaking of different attitudes about guns, I mean, it's often individuals who have been in a military culture, have had military experience, who have a lot of, humility about weapons. I mean, they look at them as a tool. You know, they don't look at them in the same glamorized ways sometimes that other gun owners might. Maybe just some reverence for the fact that these are indeed, you know, lethal products. But it's interesting, his comment reminds me of another part of my book, which is really thinking about how gun violence is portrayed in dime novels and in Westerns and in all of these legends and fables in our pop culture versus the reality of how guns are used, okay? So the typical dime novel from the 1800s always had a white hat and a black hat. You know, there's a good guy and there's a bad guy, and there's a showdown with guns, and virtue prevails. And these novels tend to overestimate both the number of people that the hero has killed in his life, and they also tend to overestimate sort of the logic of the gun violence. It's always about justice or vengeance, retribution. It always has some sort of moral code behind it. In reality, most of the gun violence that happens in this country, first off, 60% of gun deaths are suicide. Okay, so they're not actually homicide. 2% are accidental. And among the homicides, a lot of it is impulsivity, intoxication, anger. You know, it's violence that happens within communities, not between good guys and bad guys in these ways that gun violence is envisioned. So the narrative that we have and have had for decades now about gun violence is very discordant with the reality of how guns get used. And I think your caller is pointing to that. It's also true that, you know, the precision of gun violence, I mean, the kind of stuff that happens in Hollywood is completely unrealistic. I mean, it's not surprising, but, you know, this is how a lot of Americans encounter guns. You know, it's through movies and stories.
Well, in fact, we had a caller who couldn't hold on, who wanted to say that the movies that I think he watched in the 70s, I think is the decade he was saying, encouraged him to want to have a gun. And I wish I knew what movies he was talking about, but maybe I'm just guessing.
Well,
Dirty Harry or something.
No, actually, I write about that in my book. Dirty Harry, his gun, even though it's not actually a very friendly gun, it's a very loud report, sales skyrocketed after the Dirty Harry series. So there was a direct link between Clint Eastwood's use of the gun, now the model's escaping me, and the sales of that Smith & Wesson model. So there's definitely a very strong connection there. And in terms of just the production of gun stories and stories about gunslingers, really a lot of that is a product of the mid-1900s. It's a product of the Cold War, looking back on the frontier, looking back on the Wild West. The number of media expressions of the gunslinger is just staggering. There are about 35 million paperbacks sold. You know, 8 out of the 10 top primetime TV shows were Westerns. There were 1,400 Western movies produced between 1935 and 1960. So a lot of what we feel that we know about guns in history actually comes from the mid-20th century talking about the 19th century, telling stories about the frontier. That was another purpose with my book, was to try to introduce another America into that story that's more historically grounded.
A caller just dropped who I think wanted to say, is there any evidence that Hollywood and the gun makers were in cahoots?
Well, I found some evidence of that because Winchester is my focus, and there's a movie, Winchester 73, that came out in 1950, and the company was very closely involved. It was sort of an early example of product placement, I guess, because they were involved in finding the Winchester rifle that could be used in the movie and talking about the movie with the producers. So I've seen anecdotes like that. But most definitely, the gun industry in its advertisement and in its self-presentation was becoming very aware of the power of these stories and these histories. So they started talking about, you know, the gun being famous in the past and drawing on the narratives and advertisement.
Let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask your guest today the question about a possible example of really the success of the marketing of the gun culture with respect to the Second Amendment and free speech. I mean, the one area we have for voting, one side of the aisle says we need to register for voting, but they don't want to register a gun. And yet the other side says you have a constitutional right to vote, but you don't have a constitutional right to register your gun. It doesn't make sense on both sides that there's this dichotomy between free speech and voting versus your owning a gun. So I was just wondering if it's the marketing that caused that the success of that dichotomy to exist in both parties. Thanks.
Well, that's an interesting question. I probably want to give that more thought. But one thing that is true today is the Second Amendment itself is now helping to sell guns. I know people who buy guns simply because they're upset about gun control legislation in the state of Maryland. So sales and the Second Amendment and marketing are much more closely tied today in the 21st century than they were before. And passing gun control legislation can often cause a big surge in gun purchases. That's definitely happened in Maryland before. But it's interesting to think about the Second Amendment and the First Amendment because, in comparison, in other ways, I mean, the First Amendment, with guns, it's almost thought, well, we can understand it all in relationship to the Second Amendment, and that's all the gun culture is. It would sort of be like trying to figure out free speech and public speech by only interpreting the First Amendment. When we know that there's a publishing industry, we have to know how journalism works, we have to know about how social media works, and that there's a whole industry that produces speech that we also need to understand if we want to understand the First Amendment and the idea of free speech. But with guns, it's been very, very exclusively on the Second Amendment and on constitutional interpretations and not on how guns are marketed, how the industry works. It's been amazingly invisible.
Matt on Facebook says, I just traveled to England and I felt safer there than almost any American city I've been in. How the gun industry convinced us that living armed and in fear is our only option confounds me. It doesn't have to be this way. We can change this paradigm. We'll ask our guest if we can change this paradigm or if she sees gun culture in America changing in the future after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Pamela Haag. She is the author of The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. We welcome your questions for her, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. When we come back, we'll also ask Pamela what she thinks about George Zimmerman saying that he's going to auction off the gun that he used to kill Trayvon Martin 4 years ago. He says that that pistol is a piece of American history. What do you think of that? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela Haag is a historian and an author, and her book is about the history of America's gun culture, where it came from, how our love affair with guns began. She says, despite popular opinion, it did not start with the adoption of the Second Amendment. It really got going when gun companies told us that we wanted guns, that we needed guns. The marketing and promotions of gun companies played a big role. Well, we welcome your thoughts and your questions. What is your attitude toward guns? Do you own a gun? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I mentioned Matt on Facebook saying that he felt safer in England than he felt in almost any American city that he has ever been in, and mm-hmm. thought that we can change this paradigm. He says that a gun owner's need to feel safe should not infringe on his ability to feel safe. I guess what are your thoughts on this, Pamela?
Changing the paradigm, that's a really interesting comment. And in fact, you know, even just to put some historical context on that, even in 1928, there were 10,050 homicides in the United States compared to maybe 284 in Great Britain. So really for the last 100 years, that's been a pattern around homicide, and guns were involved in 71% of those homicides even by the 1920s. So, yeah, in terms of feeling safe, there are different schools of thought, and it's certainly one opinion borne out in other countries that personal, individual, civilian gun ownership does not make us safer. There's also some argue, you know, others have a right to feel safe from gun violence. So, yes, we have the Second Amendment right to own a gun, but Americans also have a reasonable expectation of being safe from gun violence. In terms of changing all of this, I think it's a mixed bag because demographically, actually the number of households with guns, as I was saying earlier, has declined. There's not as much of an interest in hunting. You know, that's been an intergenerational way that young boys were introduced to guns. That's really declined. But at the same time, the political aspects of this and the charge around the gun seem only to be getting more dramatic and accelerated. So changing this, I think, would mean complementing what we say about guns and what we know about guns with new narratives. For example, thinking about it as an industry and a business, which is kind of a way to demystify the gun. You know, when we look at it like a product that was sold, that was marketed, at least that provides a different vantage point, a different perspective on these mythologies about the gun.
Let's take a call from Dave in Dunn County. Hi, Dave.
Hello. My ex-wife Hello. Was laying in bed one night. Someone put a hand over her mouth and said, "If you scream, I'll kill you." He raped her in her own bed. He came in through the window. She called me up the next day and said, "Please come stay with me and bring your guns." About 2 weeks later, this guy came in again. I woke up from a sound sleep. I was a light sleeper back then. Saw a man in our bedroom. He came back to do it again, and I shot him several times. So this is not some boogeyman that the gun companies are trying to sell guns with. This is something that happened to my wife and happens today. And Rosa Parks had somebody come through her window, recognize her. "Hey, Rosa Parks, aren't you?" "Why, yes, I am. Give me the money anyway." So this happens.
So it's not a boogeyman made up by the gun companies that there is real danger out there, Pamela?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's certainly danger, and these tragedies happen. You know, there's no denying that. It's a question of guns also get used in suicide. You know, so it cuts both ways. I mean, it can protect. It could also be used impulsively for self-destruction. There's research that having guns doesn't always work the way we want it to work. Sometimes they get turned against us. So, you know, the research on the actual relationship between violence and protection and gun ownership is pretty complicated, and that's a little beyond the scope of my book. But I think it's a question of proportion. You know, of course, there is danger, and there are times when you're going to want to have a gun, but we're also not living in, you know, the world of the zombie apocalypse. That might be overstated. Those dangers might be overstated. The solutions, you know, in the form of the gun and gun ownership might be overstated.
Yeah, and Dave, I'm sorry that you and your wife had to go through
that. That's horrible.
There was one week last month, four toddlers shot and killed either themselves or a family member after they found a gun. Just talk some about accidental deaths caused by guns like this.
Yeah, typically in a given year, accidental deaths are about 2% of gun deaths. And we could add to that, a form of that might also be a recent case in Baltimore where a young man, maybe 12 or 13, had an imitation gun, sort of a toy gun that looked so realistic that a police officer thought it was an actual gun and shot and wounded him. This is a, sort of another version of an accidental shooting. So this is a very troubling, albeit, you know, small percentage-wise number of the gun casualties in a year. And some of the things that might benefit from more research aren't even about the gun design so much as the gun environment, how guns are stored. Are there better safety cabinets? You know, are there safer ways to store guns so that we don't have these tragedies added to the tally? So there are some places where we need research just on the gun environment.
Yeah. And do you have some specific recommendations for improving gun safety?
Well, I talk about that a bit in the epilogue. Because I've spent so much time looking at the gun industry, I speculate on what a business-focused approach to gun violence might look like. You know, are there ways that we can shift our focus from the gun owner to the gun maker, and really from the Second Amendment more toward corporate responsibility? Some of the more interesting things that have happened in the last decade or two are really things that retailers have done voluntarily. After a New Orleans mass shooting, for example, Walmart decided it wasn't going to sell the assault rifle that had been involved in that shooting. They weren't compelled to do that, but they just felt that that made for good marketing and just good consumer citizenship. So one recommendation would be consumer activism. The gun industry also enjoys a lot of protections today from civil liability. Any research that might be construed as supportive of gun control doesn't receive federal funding. So the research funds are more limited for understanding gun violence in the gun business than for other subjects. So it might be time to revisit some of those protections that the gun industry enjoys that no other industry enjoys. There's been a lot of talk lately about smart gun technology, and that would certainly speak to the accidental deaths and perhaps to the suicides as well and to the criminal market, the secondhand market in guns. Smart gun technology would just be a way to design a gun so that only the owner can use it. And it's not a flawless idea. There are problems with that idea. It's not universally applauded, but it is something that might benefit from some more development and some more thought and research. And again, it would be a way to tackle the problem that doesn't really impinge on the Second Amendment, that doesn't speak so much to the gun owner as to the gun business.
Well, we saw in the news yesterday that George Zimmerman wants to auction the gun that he used to kill Trayvon Martin 4 years ago. He said that the 9mm pistol is a piece of American history. What's your reaction to that?
I saw that. At first, I actually thought it was something out of The Onion.
Yeah.
I mean, I was flabbergasted, but a more reasonable head has prevailed because GunBroker.com, which is where he wanted to sell it, and that's a very well-managed site, so So they wanted no part of that. So I actually don't think that he's going to be able to lift his gun there. But in some ways, it's a very extreme example of how much the gun has been celebrated as an object and as almost a totem, that he could think that this instrument of a murder, you know, was legitimate as an historical object. It just really shows this strange mystique that for Zimmerman attached to this gun.
Sylvia in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi there. I would like to speak to the reality that people have illusions about what a gun can do for them. And that people never talk about, you know, aside from the accidental use of the guns, how often a person has a gun that either is not useful to them in a situation or escalates a situation that could have been solved in another way.
Yeah. We have just a minute to go. Brief reaction to that, Pamela?
No, that's a really good point. And I would add to that simply the number of gun homicides and incidents that are about impulsivity, that are about being intoxicated and having a gun, that are about anger, you know, and poor impulse control. I mean, again, the historical mystique of the gun is it's all about good versus evil, and it's defending ourselves against tyranny. But in actual use and in reality, the caller is closer to the truth. There is a lot of chaos, you know, around gun use. There's just not the sort of showdown that we tend to imagine. And it does, there is a spiral. The instrumentality effect holds that the more guns you have around, the tendency is you're going to have more gun violence. Not every researcher agrees with that thesis, but from my reading, most researchers do. So that is an issue of escalation.
Yeah, and we're
The more guns, the more gun violence you're going to perpetuate.
And we'll have to leave it there. We are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pamela Haag is the author of The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Thanks to Nyasia Ellison and to Brianne Shasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening, and thank you for all of your support during our just concluded spring membership drive. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.